college, I was good friends with a girl named Chloe, and she wasn't religious at all, and her family was not religious either, but Chloe loved singing and listened to a lot of music and joined a couple of choruses, and thus, she encountered Christian religious texts, which she'd asked me about. Similar to my friends who turned to me in art history class when we were studying all the European art and said, "What is this Bible story about?" I had a cultural advantage called a cultural privilege in that I could identify the story of the prodigal son or spot Jacob binding Israel, Isaac on the mountain without checking my notes. So I had the advantage of familiarity. But one time I remember vividly where Chloe had the advantage. Well, not the same kind of advantage. She had a different kind of advantage when she arrived to chorus one day and sight-read a new piece of music and heard this Bible passage, the Beatitudes, those blessings of Jesus, for the very first time. And I remember how awed she was. She was reading with fresh eyes, "Blessed are they that mourn," and singing it in Sweet Honey in the Rock's beautiful arrangement, "Blessed are they that mourn," and it bowled her over. Whereas, I don't remember the first time I read the Beatitudes. They'd always been there. They had never bowled me over because I was used to them, and perhaps too used to them. Anyway, I remember my friend's face that day as she appreciated this text. "Wow," she said. "Did Jesus say that?" she said. "Yes," I said. "And okay, Talitha, so why don't they write this up in the courthouses instead of the Ten Commandments?" She asked as if I could answer that question. "No, seriously," she said. "This is way more powerful than the Ten Commandments. Why don't you Christians, post it up everywhere?" I took a while to think about that. I took a day to think about it, actually, and the next day in rehearsal, I leaned over to her and I said, "I don't think Christians put the Beatitudes up in public places because, to be honest, I don't think we know what these words even mean." Now, 20 years later, and a couple of degrees under my belt, and I work in a church that does have these words posted on a wall, prizes to those who know which wall where. But I'm still not sure we know what these words mean. But I am committed to them, and I'm doing my best to post them on the walls of my life. And so I'm grateful to my friend for allowing me that wise insight that day when she let me see through her eyes to see this text, fresh and new. "Blessed are the poor." Can you let that really hit you? Can you let that punch you in the gut with all the force of its challenge? Can we hear the puzzle, the mystery in those words? The word makarios, which we translate here as blessed, has a wider range of meanings. It includes to receive a blessing, to be counted as happy, to be well off, hashtag blessed, or to be given honor. But the recipients of these blessings are exactly the opposite of these things. It's a riddle. Blessed are those who are the opposite of blessed. Well off are you who are hungry. Happy are you who are sad. Honored are you who are being publicly shamed. Whew, so I want to put the brakes on here and do a little theological steering, because if we keep going in that direction, emphasizing the impossibility of the Beatitudes, it strikes me as a kind of spiritual gaslighting. As if Jesus is telling us not to trust our own senses. If you haven't heard of gaslighting, it's a psychological term that comes from an old movie called Gaslight, where a manipulative husband secretly dims and flickers the lights in his house, and then when his wife complains about it, he denies that it's happening in order to make her feel like she's crazy and make her more dependent on him. And it happens in many more subtle ways, too. Maybe somebody thinks you're making up the symptoms of your illness. Or maybe your boss blames you for not completing an assignment they had not assigned. Or maybe you just know what it's like to feel like somebody is denying your reality. Anyway, I want us to find a way to read the Beatitudes that doesn't make us feel like Jesus is gaslighting us. I need to be able to follow Christ and also trust my gut instincts. Do you know what I mean? I need to know that when I am mourning, I am actually sad, not happy. And I need to validate the fact that dishonor feels bad, not joyful. Our gut instincts are gifts from God as well, and we ought to honor them. So we steer away from that bad interpretation and go looking for another way to approach the Beatitudes, and we run into another kind of trouble. That's the trouble we find when we treat them as a checklist of virtues. I can blame this problem on the differences between the Gospels. You see, the Gospel of Matthew shares these Beatitudes, but in a longer list. And they spiritualized some things and added some things. So Matthew says, blessed are the poor in spirit and those who hunger for justice. And he also has Jesus bless the meek, the merciful, the pure-hearted, and the peacemakers. And those are fine goals you can aim for. There are skills to peacemaking and spiritual practices that can keep you hungering for justice. In fact, we'll be learning some of them here next week. But Luke's Beatitudes, the ones we're looking at today, are starker, probably more original. They're certainly more difficult and need to be treated differently. They're not a moral checklist. Because although we do challenge ourselves to be brave and accepting when suffering comes to us, still, it doesn't make sense to deliberately seek out sorrow and poverty and persecution. We get caught here, though, don't we? We want God's blessing, so we try to fake it. I can say that because I've done it. I have used the cover of the Beatitudes to semi-piously hide my talents, my privileges, and my power, pretending that I have less than I do. That can't be it. Jesus couldn't be saying, blessed are those who perform false humility. Oh, no. And have you been there? Have you ever hidden or denied your talents or your power? One of my older nephews, a bright young boy, realized that not all his kindergarten classmates could read. And he saw that they felt bad about this. And so he started to pretend he couldn't read either, so that he wouldn't stick out. That's not it. We need to remember, blessed are you who are poor, not blessed are you who act poor. You really can't fake your way through this world. And this is essentially why I think we haven't written the Beatitudes on the walls of our public buildings, because we really don't know what to do with them. We try to interpret them, we try to live them out in our daily lives, but they kind of push back on us, they challenge us, they puzzle us. And when we approach, we end up tripping over our own feet. And if you keep going in this Bible passage, you have the woes to deal with too. Woe to you who are rich. Woe to you who are happy. Ouch. That's a slap in the face, even if you creatively translate woe as watch out. And then you keep going and you hear love your enemies, and well, nobody knows what to do with that. And so for most of my life, I've been dancing around the Beatitudes, not sure what to do with them, entranced by their challenge and their mystery. Until this year, when life conspired to give me one precious experience where I was able to see the Beatitudes with new eyes. I'll start telling this story with background from a few years earlier. When I was a hospital chaplain during my residency at UCSF, I often found myself stuck when it came to praying for patients who were very sick. I would pray, but I'd kind of be holding my fingers crossed behind my back. You see, I felt conflicted praying for healing when I knew it was possible they might not ultimately be healed. And so I danced around it, and I'd pray for them in deliberately vague terms, and I'd hold back. And because of this, there was a wall between us. Now, of course, if you imagine this wall, the patients were on the dangerous and vulnerable side of that wall, while I was safe on my side. You could see the different sides because they were wearing hospital gowns on their side of the wall, while I was wearing my badge, a badge of safety, that is, that identified me as the strong one. On their side of the wall was the hospital bed and the padded socks and the call button and the bed alarm that meant they had to ask permission to go to the bathroom. On my side was a swivel office chair and important papers and the sturdy shoes meant for clocking miles up and down the hospital corridors. I was rich on my side of the wall. I was full and happy and blessed and well off, while they were poor and hungry and desperate and suffering, and that wall kept us apart. And I wouldn't even reach over the wall long enough to say a prayer that felt like a reach. Perhaps you've known a wall like that before. Perhaps you've even just been in a food pantry, divided by that line of tables with the givers on one side and the receivers on the other. Or maybe you've seen that wall somewhere else. Well, I've spent most of my life on the safe side of that wall. I have been to the ER, but I've never spent a night in one of those beds. I've never had to rely on the call button or had a pair of those padded socks given to me. But earlier this year, I did have a chance to be on the other side of that wall, nonetheless. My mother was in the hospital bed at Manhattan Sloan Kettering, and she was in recovery from a huge operation that left her ultimately cancer-free, though we didn't know that at the time. And it also left her lacking a few internal organs. So she was in that bed, and I was next to her, on one of those chairs that pulls out like a tiny couch to make this uncomfortable, narrow place for a family member to spend the night. And the hospital chaplain said a few words of blessing to me while she slept, wishing her a complete recovery, and I held on to those precious words like pieces of spiritual gold. I was on the other side of that wall, trying desperately to climb back up into safety. And I was praying the prayer I never wanted to pray before, asking God for something that I had no way of knowing if it would be granted. Meanwhile, my mom, resting in her hospital bed, was doing some serious spiritual work. She was trying to come to terms with the enormous wave of love that had been washing over her through the course of her chemo and culminating in her surgery. She, like me, was not used to being a receiver. In her 35 years of ordained ministry, she usually stayed on the giver side of that wall. But around her were all the signs of the love that she had been receiving. Cards from 12, count them, and you are in one of them, 12 churches praying for her. Pictures from her family and friends who had worn headscarves and taken selfies and written songs for her every Monday since she started chemo. She was surrounded. And when she rolled out of recovery on her gurney, she had laughed groggily and said, All this love, it's gonna make a believer out of me. Well, those of us who had seen her minister to so many churches for 35 years were pretty sure she had already qualified as a believer. But her experience of true vulnerability, emotional and interpersonal and physical, mortal vulnerability, had opened her up to God in a way she just hadn't been opened before. And as I watched from my uncomfortable little couch, it opened me up too. So when I came back from that time in New York and I returned here, I resumed my regular Saturday morning routine as a volunteer at the Children's Hospital, telling godly play stories. And on my first day back, I was surprised to find there was no longer a wall between me and the patients. I wasn't sure what was different at first, then I felt it. When I asked, what should we pray for? And the kids said, pray for healing. And there was nothing holding me back from that pure request. So I prayed for the kids' healing full stop with my whole heart. Because now I knew from the inside that sweet and painful longing, the cry of the heart, that urgent request, which you don't know if it's going to be fulfilled. And as I left the hospital and buckled my helmet on to ride my bike home, I heard the Beatitudes singing, pure and uncomplicated in my heart. And I heard some new ones too. Blessed are the sick, for they know how precious life is. Blessed are the broken, for they shall be made whole. I realized that even the woes didn't sting anymore. They made sense now. Watch out! You who are healthy, you will be sick, I promise. Look out, you who are whole now, for your brokenness will surely come to you. And are you ready for it? Have you spent your whole life avoiding vulnerability? Look out, it's coming. It will hurt, but it will also open you up. Today, we celebrate All Saints' Day, and we remember the lives of those who went before us. And we might be tempted, not just on days like today, but even sometimes at a funeral itself, we might be tempted to only remember the good, strong things about people. We remember their riches, their strength, we remember what they gave us. But as you call them to mind today, I'd like you to remember also their times of vulnerability and need. We're tempted to look away from the hard stuff, but Jesus leads us to go bravely into the hardest of places and not to be afraid of the brokenness we find there, for that is how the light gets in. The hymn we sang at the beginning of our service said, we, meaning us mortals here, we feebly struggle, and they, the saints, in glory shine. But if your eyes are open to see it this way, we know that they have struggled too. And we, even in the midst of our struggles, we also shine with the glory of God who blesses us in our vulnerability. Thanks be to God.